the Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast.
Hey guys, we're back again for another installment of the Rice Podcast here on the Mississippi Crop Situation blog or whatever it is. And I got as always with me Jason Bond and new guest today, Dr. Wayne Ebelhair. And you know, we were sitting around talking and he's seen 38 years of getting up and driving up here. And man, that's a lot of changing, I bet, that's going on and in 38 years of coming to the research station here at Stoneville.
Well, you know, Bobby, it hadn't been quite 38 years, but time has really passed fast. I started to work at Mississippi State November the 1st of 1980, and some of you guys weren't even around at that time or were 2 or 3 years old, but
Bobby, you know, was just out of diapers.
Just out of diapers.
I was breathing. So
he might have been in diapers.
Well, I think, you know, we're going to have a good time in here today, and this will probably be continued over a series. But I think me being here with the two most senior scientists at Stoneville, even though they're separated by many years, I got that correct, right? It's Wayne, then Jason in the order of hierarchy.
Well, Lyle Pringle.
Lyle.
Yeah, Lyle. Wayne, there's Wayne, then Lyle.
Well, in the PSS department, how about that?
That's
I didn't
right.
mean to leave Lyle out.
Yeah.
Yeah, in fact, I guess I've been the senior faculty member now for several years. With me and Lyle, I came in 80 and Lyle came, I think, in 82. And then the next person that's still here is Jason. And you've been here, what, 12 years?
2006, however many.
It's hard to think about being here 26 years before that. And I was like 27, 28 years old when I came here. So I turned 65 back in March. So I have seen a few changes over the years. You know, we were sitting in the office the other day talking about computers. And when I was in college in 1971, there were no computers. My master's thesis that I started in 1975 was done on punch cards. And how many people today know what a punch card is or what an 80-column punch card is?
Well, Wayne, we've got kids in grad school today that don't remember a cassette tape, much less a punch card. Hell, some of them probably hadn't even seen CDs.
Yeah, floppy disk drives and zip drives and all the fun stuff that even we had.
So you don't think any of them have a slide rule?
No.
They might have seen a John Blue piston pump slide rule, but not a true slide rule.
So what's the, Wayne, in the time you've been here, what do you think, just off the top of your head, what's the most dramatic change, you know, in your time at DRAC? Because, I mean, it blows my mind the things that have changed, you know, since I've been here. You know, when I interviewed, by the time I got here, it had changed. But, you know, when I interviewed, one of my most vivid memories from that is the hospital green paint job on all the buildings in the shop compound. You know, that's a lot more muted now. But that's one of the things I remember. But, you know, then the other things, all the, you know, equipment that's been purchased during the time I've been here, you know, just really mind-boggling. But I know there's got to be something like that sticks out in your mind.
You know, for me, I was hired to work on cotton and rice. So, and I was in central Illinois. I grew up on a farm in western Kentucky with cows and dairy and tobacco. And the only rice I'd ever seen was on the table as a rice pudding or in Rice Krispies. And the only cotton I'd ever seen was in underwear and T-shirts and things like that. So I was actually hired to work on two crops that I'd never seen either one of those two crops grow before. But it was a real eye-opening experience because my background is in soil fertility and working with soils. And, you know, the things that I've really noticed here, when I came, I actually work on cotton, corn, and soybean now. So when I started here in 1980, we maybe have had 50,000 acres of corn that yielded 45, 50 bushels per acre. Today, in 2017, the state of Mississippi produced about 520,000 acres of corn that averaged 189 bushels per acre. So to see the change in the crop rotations over the years, since I've been here, we've grown as many as 4 million acres of soybeans. Now we're at about 2.2.
So, Wayne, you mentioned when you came here, they hired you to work in cotton and in rice, and that you had never seen either one of those. And just coincidentally, I was having a conversation earlier with one of the guys that works in our program, and we were having a similar conversation that seems like everybody's got a story of when they were hired and didn't know basically what they were doing, you know, when they got hired for their job. So were you intimidated, you know, coming to a new area of the country and then not having any background in the crops that you were hired to work in? You know, what do you remember what you were thinking coming into it?
Gosh, that's really an interesting question because, you know, I don't think I was really intimidated, but at 6'5", it's hard to intimidate somebody my size. But yeah, you know, my first job offer came from Penn State, and I turned that job down because the person whose position was there had moved up one level into administration. And I decided that, you know, I liked the concept of Stoneville. It was a tremendous appearing place to work. It was huge. And the other agronomist here was named Ish Spurgeon, and Ish was probably pushing 60 when I came. And I thought, well, you know, within 5 years, Ish retires, I could be the top dog. So I kind of thought, well, you know, I've got an opportunity to move up fast here, you know, reputation-wise. So I really felt confident that, you know, I knew my soils. I knew my soils. Rice and cotton are two crops that grow in soils, just like corn and soybeans. But, you know, over the years, I've actually had the opportunity to work in rice. I spent 20 years working in rice, doing fertility work in rice. The big difference is rice is a flooded crop. I'd not been around flooded crops before, but I'd been around corn, soybeans, tobacco. I've worked on sunflowers, mustard, medicinal plants and herbs. I've worked on a lot of different things. And
don't forget those sugar beets now.
No, not sugar beets. They were energy beet.
Which could have been crushed for sugar if you got in a bind.
The sugar people in Louisiana, the sugar cane people and the sugar beet people out west were really concerned about the South getting into the sugar business. So we ended up, they wanted to make sure we called them energy beets. But now I've also worked with sesame. And for the guys out there that are really interested in the bee populations, I've never seen anything attract more bees, pollinating bees, than the sesame did. But, you know, those are niche market crops, and we've not had a great interest in those, but, you know, a crop is a crop. You might as well look at it. So I've looked at a lot of them over the years.
So out of all the crops that we grow here in the Delta, and you talked about different staple crops of different regions and having to learn new systems coming down here, is there one that you just, man, I just love to do that. That's awesome.
Probably for me, it's going to be corn because I grew up with corn. And so when I was given the opportunity to switch from rice into corn, when corn started coming back, corn is one of those crops where I don't know what it is. It's high yielding for one thing. And I grew up with corn. You know, I'm one of these people that never grew up with sweet corn. My daddy said that with 1,500 acres of corn, if you can't find an ear to eat, do without. So
I think he was a smart man for sure.
Growing up, we grew everything on the farm except for sugar, flour, that may be all. My mom, with eight kids, I'm the oldest of eight, so my mom didn't make bread. She didn't have time to make bread. So we could buy bread at a day-old bread store. But everything else, we either grew in the garden, we grew in the orchard, we picked wild berries. I mean, that's just the way of farm life was for farm kids back then. And like I say, I'm the oldest of eight. My elementary class, I went to a Catholic elementary school out in the country in Kentucky. We had five boys and eight girls, the all country kids. Out of those five boys, we have two PhDs and an MD. So you don't have to be from big city. You just have to have a love for what you do.
That's pretty cool, man.
I don't even know how to say out of that small amount of people. Wow, that's some mighty accomplishments. It's almost speechless to say.
So, Wayne, when you got to Stoneville, working in cotton and rice, what were the hot topics at the time?
Well, back then, as it is today, of course, nitrogen management, nutrient management. You know, cotton is one of these unique crops that a lot of people may not even think about, but we farm cotton as an annual. But cotton's really not an annual. Cotton is a perennial. So too much nitrogen or too little nitrogen, both can affect yield. So learning how to manage a crop like cotton was a real challenge because If you over-fertilize it, that plant stays vegetative. It doesn't need to produce fruit to sustain itself. Whereas, you know, when I was in the Midwest, cocoa burr were a real common weed problem, and a cocoa burr only takes one leaf to produce a seed, and that plant will expend its entire energy source, every bit of energy in that plant to produce one seed. A cotton plant, on the other hand, if you stress it at all, it kicks the fruiting bodies off. It's maintaining the mother plants that I'll produce more seed next year when I get more time. So that was kind of a very unique situation. I think today we end up having a lot more plots, a lot more activities. Do we gain as much information? That's the question.
Yeah, I agree.
We can cover a lot of ground, but do we answer those needed questions? That's a good question.
Well, I think you answer around them, on the edges of them, but truly having the straight time requirement to solve a problem
at its core.
At its core, mm-hmm. That generally might take really 3 years. You know, you see a lot of these 3-year projects. There's a reason why you have a 3-year project, and to dedicate all that time to one specific idea or one specific issue, it's almost unheard of now.
Well, I think we get into a lot of breadth and not much depth. I think we're all probably guilty of that just because of the volume we can run with the resources we have now.
I think that's one of the things that, when I first got started, I didn't have a lot of studies going on. I had multiple studies, but on kind of a same topic, that were trying to look at various aspects. And, one of the things I've talked with Richard Turner is my PhD grad student. In fact, got his master's degree with Bobby. But, how you develop an idea and then how you develop that idea and what you want to do with it and everything that feeds into it. Richard's interested in going into the consulting business when he gets through. So, the project that he's working on is a soybean promotion board project it's a really intense project looking at all aspects of single row versus twin row, plant populations, desiccation, fungicides, all of it going into a final package, adding one thing at a time or taking away one thing at a time. And for Richard's interest in consulting, this is a great learning tool for him, because he gets to see everything at one time. And I think that's one of the things, you were asking earlier about things that have changed at Stoneville. That's a huge change over the last 35 years. We've got, 20 plus grad students here now?
At least.
Master's and PhD students. This center is a huge training center for students. And when they go away from here, and I was talking to a potential student today from Texas. He's actually at Oklahoma State now, but, about the way we work as a team to accomplish what we need to get done here, the teamwork that goes into no single project. In fact, no single crop grows by itself. I don't know. I'm not a weed control person. My area is soil fertility. I'm not an entomologist. But we've got a team here that you can go to, and we can work out problems. We can work out systems. Because a farmer basically has, the questions he has is, can I do it first? Can I make money at it? No matter how great our research is, if a farmer can't use it and make money at it, then it's almost like we're wasting our time, because he's not going to adopt it unless he can find a way to make a profit at it. So that's our big goal.
Especially here on an applied station.
Absolutely.
Like we have, where we do a little bit of basic research, but most everything we do here is kind of tailored to turn row, straight to the turn row results.
Fast turnaround, getting the information out there as quickly as we can.
Well, and a lot of it begins, and I guess the best term is problem solving too, because, if you've got a situation that comes up, we've addressed a lot of issues with crop rotation over the years, and that's been an area that I've been fortunate enough to be able to work in. I like crop rotation, but it's not a field of study. Those areas don't yield a lot of publications quickly. And the fact that you need those systems and it takes time to get the information, that's one of the things in my career now, having been around as long as I've been around, I've been working in crop rotations now for probably over 20 years. Crop rotations have been around a long time, but in the South, with farm programs and profitability driving everything, Corn wasn't a profitable crop. Soybean wasn't that profitable until we got, until we went to the early soybean production system when we went to irrigation. And that's kind of crazy, you know, an area that gets 53 inches of rainfall and we talk about irrigation.
Yeah, but we get that rain when we need to duck hunt, not when we need to farm.
Yeah, you're talking about crop rotation and having spent a lot of time working on it over the years. Is there anything looking back, you know, over the time that you've been here, maybe some of the stuff you were doing in the early years and now you look back on it and think, you know, dang, how did you not know that?
Well, I think the biggest thing that I've worked on that people just couldn't comprehend was plant growth regulator. You know, there's still people out there today that think that they cannot farm without plant growth regulators. But there's also people out there that think they can't farm without Roundup or can't drive a tractor themselves or things like that. But I found out a long time ago, I worked with Bill Meredith with USDA. Bill passed away several years ago. But, you know, one of the things we determined, and it was a common thought, if you put fruit on a plant and you keep that sink there, then that plant is self-regulating. That's the thing that, you know, we spent years working on plant growth regulators and the fact that if you just keep the fruit, so it kind of goes against some of the early interest in integrated pest management. But, you know, I have dabbled in a lot of different topics over the years, you know, mostly nitrogen-based because nitrogen is probably the most mobile nutrient. And nitrogen, when I was at Illinois, was about 5 cents a pound. Now it's anywhere from 55 to 75 cents a pound or more. When I first started in Rice, I was working with actually an interesting story. I was working with the guy that introduced me to my wife. He was with TVA in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. We were office mates at the University of Kentucky. And he was the head of a project at TVA working with sulfur-coated urea. Bobby's probably seen sulfur-coated urea. I don't know that you've ever worked with it.
I've worked with some that come from China, but not the TVA.
And some private industry or private got involved and thought that TVA should not be in the fertilizer selling business. So they ended up forcing TVA to give it up. It went private and went up to a dollar a pound for nitrogen. So
if you think about that and how long ago that was when you were working with that, and here it is 2018, and that's a very good product, yet it's still not being used in the real world simply because the cost, either the cost they want to sell it for, or it's really high cost to manufacture, but in the future, where do you see, you know, these new products coming online like that? You mentioned the polymers, you mentioned the sulfur coat and a lot of others that would help out environmentally, but the barrier to entry is cost.
Yeah, that's always going to be an issue. You know, a farmer is looking for the most effective material that he can use, but he has to look at the bottom line. The specialized crops like containerized plants, they may have a place for some of these more expensive materials, but from a row crop standpoint, you know, nitrogen, and I grew up with ammonium nitrate, you know, and it only took a few fools to knock out ammonium nitrate. All you had to do was blow up a federal building in Oklahoma City, and a very good fertilizer material that's a very, very cheap source of nitrogen. Now, today, ammonium nitrate's very difficult to find. So urea, you know, we're using mainly urea a lot for rice and things because of ammonia source. UAN solution is really popular here, urea ammonium nitrate solutions. And I think for the farmers, the key is not so much the differences in the sources. And I've worked on a lot of sources over the year, including Bulldog soda, some of them, sodium nitrate, that was a common term. Chilean nitrate, which was calcium nitrate, ammonium nitrate, anhydrous ammonia still used, not used in the South. It was actually being used here on the experiment station when I started back in 1980.
Well, I think we've got a plaque on the wall back there talking about anhydrous here at Stoneville.
That's correct. In fact, I was part of the group that put that together. Stoneville has been recognized by the Ag and Bioengineering Society for that particular product, Stoneville was the first location for direct application of anhydrous ammonia to the soil. But that was, I think, in the 30s or in the 40s, but took an old, something, a Virginia stock or something, and they mounted a tank onto it and directly injected gas into the soil.
So what you're telling me is you had a mule pulling a turning plow with some explosive, kill-you-dead anhydrous right behind it.
That's correct. Works like a charm.
That wouldn't make it in today's personal protective equipment world, I don't think.
I don't think they'd let the mule do it either.
That's about right.
Let alone the people. Well, Wayne, I hijacked your afternoon a couple of hours ago, and we spent a lot of time together this afternoon, so we appreciate you coming over here and, you know, walking over to the other building with us and recording this, and we'll definitely get you back in here to talk about some more of this. I always enjoy visiting with you, but so we're going to wrap it up for today, folks, and we appreciate y'all listening, and if we can do anything for you, just give us a call, and we'll get out to you as soon as we can.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is produced by the Mississippi State University Extension Service.